This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're also online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer Tom Bissell's father served and was wounded in Vietnam. Tom was born after U.S. combat troops returned home in 1973. He was a baby when Saigon fell in 1975. The war, however, has been very much a part of his life. He says he has spent most of his life thinking about it. Tom Bissell is the author of The Father of All Things, A Marine, His Son, and the Legacy of Vietnam. This is from Bissell's author's note. The war did not torment or haunt or injure me. Rather, Vietnam was an abstract shadow that rarely left my other thoughts undarkened. That shadow would become less abstract, however, when Tom traveled to Vietnam with his father, former Marine Captain John Bissell. We'll talk about the war and that trip in this portion of the program. Tom Bissell is our guest. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Tom Bissell is also the author of Chasing the Sea and God Lives in St. Petersburg. A contributing editor for Harper's Magazine, he was awarded the Rome Fellowship by the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His new book, The Father of All Things, A Marine, His Son, and the Legacy of Vietnam, is published by Pantheon Books. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Tom Bissell, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, it's my pleasure to be here.
In the book, at one point, you know, there are two types. Vietnam veterans. There are probably two types of veterans of any war, those who talk about the war and those who don't. Your dad talked about it, but you say that deepened the abyss between you. How so?
Well, I think it made visible the abyss. I was just thinking about that line the other day, and I had one of those instances where I thought, oh, that's a much better version of the line than the one I actually came out with, because writers do still rewrite their books years after they've been published. And I realized that it hadn't deepened the abyss. What it had done is, if he'd never said anything about it, I never would have had any sense of how enormous this abyss between someone who's been in a war and someone who hasn't been. But by the very fact of his talking about it and revealing details about it and sharing things with me, you really do get a sense of how far apart from this person you are standing in some fundamental sense.
Yeah. When your dad was having a bad night, he'd wake you up to talk about the war. What was that like for a 10-year-old?
That didn't, you know, happen on an extraordinarily large number of occasions, but it happened often enough that it was a strange experience. It was profoundly troubling, and I think that was a lot of what I meant in that part that you so wonderfully read there about Vietnam not really leaving a lot of my other thoughts undarkened is this image of my father when I was a very young boy, you know, a little bit in his cups with tears in his eyes, sitting on the foot of my bed, desperate to tell me something that was very important for him to get clear in his own head. And sometimes it was decisions he'd made. My dad was in combat support, so he ran convoys up and down the coast of Vietnam, you know, bringing ammunition or water or various things that, you know, the combat units would need. And, of course, in an insurgency guerrilla war, combat support winds up being, you know, some of the people who get hit the most often.
Yeah.
So decisions that my father had made in his role as a lieutenant and then later a captain that tormented him, things that he'd done that he thought had led to the deaths of people that he was very close to. And so it was questions like that, and that is a huge thing for a kid to try to reconcile, you know, with the father or a parent figure who's supposed to be one of sort of unlimited power and authority, to see a parent figure in this situation where they're pretty existentially, you know, flayed right down to the bone is pretty unnerving. And I want to also say that my father was a totally a stand-up guy and a wonderful father and almost every way.
Yeah.
And when you hear the phrase Vietnam vet, I certainly would not include my father amongst one of these bedraggled, forest wandering, troubled, mumbling to himself kinds of vets. He wasn't like that at all. In fact, he was very together and on the outside a perfectly normal man. But it was only when you got close to him in sort of the small hours of the night where a lot of this lasting sort of damage that had been done to him came out.
Yeah. Well, I really like him.
You like him?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I mean, he just comes across as a great dad. And it was fun realizing that his nickname was Nice Guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we should tell that story.
Tell that story.
I asked my father what his Marine Corps nickname was, because basically every Marine has a nickname, and some of the really famous Marines like Lou, Silent Lou Walt, and Victor Brute Krulak, and Chesty Puller, all these famous Marines. So I asked my dad, well, what was your nom de guerre? And he revealed that it was Nice Guy, John Nice Guy Bissell. And I was like, Nice Guy? Why was your name Nice Guy? And he tells the story of going down a road, taking fire in a somewhat, excitable condition, trying to get out of various harassment fire that he was absorbing, and he hit a water buffalo. And while the general flying over in the observation chopper was ordering them to get out of there, my dad insisted on paying back this peasant, which was their orders, is that if they destroyed the local people's animals, they had to reimburse them. So my father emptied out the R&R fund for his men and paid this poor old man back for as destroying, as my father called it, his car, his engine, his plow, his everything. And after that, my father earned the name Nice Guy, and he said, I just tried to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that was kind of a really beautifully little revealing window into my father's idea of the war, because he was there in 65 and 66 before things sort of turned definitively controversial, let's say. It was when America's sort of moral righteousness in the war, I think, had not been degraded to the extent that it would be by the end of it in the minds of many observers.
How did your dad feel about the war at the end of the war?
Well, this is a very complicated question, and I think, like a lot of vets, he feels as though the war victory was squandered. I disagree with that, and we could have a long conversation with that, but he feels, I'm just trying to let the viewers know that this is not my position. It's a position that I, respect and would never argue much with anyone about, but he feels that victory was at hand and squandered, and that had it not been for X, Y, or Z, we would have won, and we did not fight the war the way we could have fought quite as expansively or as viciously, shall we say, and that he's proud of his service and feels that defending the imperiled freedom of people South Vietnam was worth sacrifice, and that the civilian command had really blew the war for the men on the ground. That would be his position, and it wasn't until that was his position for many years, and it wasn't until going back that I think my father began to realize that things were probably a lot more complicated than that, and then even given all the suffering and all the death, that perhaps going to Vietnam allowed him to see that maybe things happened, maybe things worked out all right, for everyone in the end, possibly.
Yeah.
And that was a very moving thing to see him come to that conclusion.
Yeah. How was it that you and your dad made that trip?
Well, I was, writing for magazines. Sometimes delightful people will call you and ask you to out to lunch, and you go have a very expensive lunch with the magazine editor, and this particular one wanted me to write something for GQ, a guy named Devin Friedman, a wonderful guy, a good friend of mine now. And I had some ideas, but he wasn't interested in them, and just in the course of this lunch, I started talking about my father and, just as friends talk, and he thought, well, this is what we're going to do. We're going to send you and your dad to Vietnam together. So it was Devin's idea. I had no idea it was going to be a book. The minute I landed in Vietnam with my dad, who was excited to go. He was very much ready to go, not trepidatious at all.
Yeah.
And the minute we landed there, I think we were there for 2 days, where I thought to myself, this has got to be my next book. It's just too big a topic, and it's just dredging up too much stuff in both of us for me not to write about this at length.
You were a little anxious, though, going in.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how my dad was going to respond, and he seemed totally calm and cool. But it's a weird thing going to the place of, this mythic place that neither of us, that I'd never been to and that he hadn't been for 40 years. So I think the really cool thing that happened, like right away, we get there, and I just barely allude to this in the story in the book, but this old Vietnamese woman was struggling with her luggage on the baggage claim, and my dad dropped everything he was doing and helped her carry all of her baggage and helped her put it on a cart for her and helped her off, and she thanked him, and he smiled and nodded at her. And I remember just thinking, wow, that was so weirdly affecting, and I don't even really know why, you know, but watching him help this old Vietnamese woman was really sort of sweet, and that kind of set the tone for the whole trip.
Yeah. At the outset of the book, you begin the first chapter by putting us in your dad's shoes. It's April 1975. We feel Vietnam a dream. It's been 8 years. What was life like at the Bissell household in Escanaba, Michigan, mm-hmm. at this point?
Well, this is the beginning of the book in which I take the mildly controversial tact of in a book of narrative nonfiction and history and memoir of opening up with what is essentially a novella of an imagined scene from mm-hmm. my parents' marriage. It was kind of an accident how that scene came to be written. I initially just wanted to write like a 4 to 5 page prologue about that moment, and I wrote the first sentence in the second person addressed to my father, "You come home from work," and I remember thinking, well, why the heck did I do that? That's rather strange. And so then I began writing him maybe this, like, letter, I guess, about what were you like then, and I tried to do as little research about my parents as possible, because I really wanted to really fully imagine my way into their lives without feeling burdened by what, quote, really happened, you know, and so I tried to do as full of a full portrayal of what their marriage would have been like at the time. And they were both, you know, had things that they questioned my opinion on, but both of them thought that it was essentially very accurate and were kind of accused me of using the other for pumping damaging information out of them, so, which in fact was not what happened at all, but... I was really pleased with how that section worked out. It was a complete accident. Some of the reviews have kind of taken issue with this rather odd device, but I'm really pleased with it, and I hope it has a kind of haunting and you know.
I think it works.
Thank you.
I think it works well. I suspect that children of all war veterans wonder, as you have, about what that generation saw and experienced, what it's meant for them. Have you talked about this with other adult children of veterans?
Only Vietnam veterans, for the most part. But now that I've been going on tour for this mm-hmm. book, in every audience there'll be a World War II veteran's son or daughter. And some of the most moving experiences I've had with this book have just been talking to people and people revealing like how near the end of their father's life, he finally sat down and recorded to tape some of his D-Day memories, for instance. And just how awful the experience, how awful, but also how cleansing and liberating it was to listen to this person that they loved, sort of uncork, you know, this bottle inside of them and let out all of this really sometimes horrifying stuff, and how they really had this sense of having never really had a full measure of this person that they were so close to in so many ways because of this decades-long process of not ever really talking about it. So I've talked to a lot of vets' children now, and most of them, I think the vast majority of them are people who were never really talked to by their fathers. So I feel very lucky that I was able to do this with my dad, and I hope that, you know, maybe our story can sort of have some maybe surrogate power for people who maybe did not get such a chance.
Yeah. Are Iraq veterans reading this book?
Well, my friends that are over there certainly are. I have one very good friend who's a major and has had 4 tours of duty now. And she is the one who got me embedded with the Marines a couple of summers ago. And I went and spent time with her unit. And she was a major and does exactly what my dad did in Vietnam, which is combat support. And she's reading it as we speak, and I'm awaiting her verdict. So I hope she feels I did the Corps proud, you know. But I do think because of the similarly ambiguous, well, Vietnam, for lack of a better word, has a contested, controversial, and I would say ambiguous place in the American narrative. However you feel about it, I don't think anyone can dispute that. I think it seems pretty clear that Iraq is headed for a similarly disputed place in our history of, you know, and the cosmology of our wars. Were they justified? Was it the right decision? And I have to think that, from what I've seen, veterans of wars that have these contested placements tend to have a stranger and, in many ways, I think, more difficult time dealing with it. And I think the children of those veterans have carries over into some of their lives as well. And so I think we can anticipate something very similar happening to the Iraq War veterans and their children as well.
Yeah. People in Vietnam, the generation that fought, and their children, do you have a sense of what their feelings are?
The Vietnamese?
Yeah.
I do. I have a very good sense of that. Uh-huh. One of my best friends in Vietnam is a young man who's 30 years old, whose father was a colonel in the Viet Cong. I've spent many a night drinking rice wine and having dinner at their house. He's a wonderful man. His family is like my family in Vietnam, and you know, his father and my father tried to kill each other. And his father and I have talked about the war many times, and he maintains that the United States wanted to conquer and exploit Vietnam. And this was a man who was re-educated by the communists afterwards. Even though he was in the Viet Cong, he was not sufficiently doctrinaire in his politics, so he was sent to a re-education camp, and he still thinks he made the right decision and fought for the right side. And because it was just to him a purely nationalist question. Do we want to be ruled by foreigners, or do we want to rule ourselves? And I'm not trying to, you know, justify or defend that position. I'm just saying that's how he feels, and he feels it very strongly. So, but he never talks about the war, not to his son, ever. And I think his son, my friend, told me that basically he thinks that's the case because everyone in that generation suffered so much, the Vietnamese. It's impossible to be an adult Vietnamese during, you know, a few decades there and not have some really hard decisions to make about what you were going to do and what side you were going to be on. And so the extent to which Vietnamese veterans of the war don't talk about it, I think the silence on the Vietnamese side of things is a lot more profound than it is on the American side, particularly amongst veterans of the South Vietnamese War, who lost even more thoroughly than the United States did. Those veterans' children, I think, are faced with some of the most harrowing and difficult to deal with legacies. South Vietnam was basically erased, and those people, veterans of that war, none of those people got any medical benefits, for instance. Many of them were re-educated. They were not eligible for any governmental aid, you know, as veterans. It's a horrible legacy, and that those wounds are still, I think, more those wounds are still touchier and more alive today than, say, any wounds between, you know, Vietnamese and Americans are. I think those divisions between North and South Vietnamese.
And maybe by looking away from the wound, you have a chance.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Maybe by averting your eyes, if you're wounded, maybe by averting your eyes, paying attention to other things.
Yes.
You are able to go on.
I think that's most of the veterans that I've spoken to have. It has essentially come down to that for them. It's a decision of whether you want to live with this every day, or if you just want to move on. Because essentially, you do have to make a decision at some point. How much of this do you want in your life? And my dad, I think, certainly made that decision. And I think from the time that I was in my late teens, he really began to change a lot and just mellow out a lot. So by the time we actually went to Vietnam together, he was thrilled and really, really happy to do it.
Yeah.
But that took a long time. That took a long time.
Well, some years ago, I talked with a counselor, a VA counselor, and this was 1980, maybe. This was quite a while ago. And we were talking about this very thing, and what he was saying is it's important to come to a point where what you can do is you don't seal it up entirely, but you put it away a little bit. You box it up and you put it on a closet shelf, and it's there if you want to go to it.
Yeah.
But it's not in your face.
My dad says something sort of similar in the book where takes his brain out of his head. He pantomimes taking his brain out of his head and putting it in an envelope and stuffing it in his shirt pocket. I think that's it's kind of a similar trope, you know, to keep it on you, keep it near to you, but just take it out of yourself, you know, put it someplace slightly separate from yourself.
Tom Bissell is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author most recently of The Father of All Things, A Marine, His Son, and the Legacy of Vietnam. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join us with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now on line four. Calling in on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking this call. I find the author and his book engaging, and I'm certainly going to check into it. As a child of a World War II veteran, Navy veteran, who saw a lot of action, Lady Gulf and Mindanao and a lot of violence, over the years, I can remember as a child talking, having my dad and his friends, as we also went to different cities and visited VFWs and the like, really talking about their experiences. Why is it that it appears, at least from the literature and from what you're saying, that veterans of other wars, especially, you know, WW2, are less reluctant to talk about their experiences? Because I've never met anyone, and I don't know if my father has, that refused to talk about their experiences. But Vietnam conflict, maybe it was because it was a conflicted engagement that is, you know, recessed in either the memories or reluctance to speak about it. I'd just like to hear your take on that.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Is that when a war does have loses some of the moral righteousness of it, like World War II, you know, the men who fought in World War II, I don't think anyone would dispute, had to do some awful things on their way to, you know, saving Western civilization from two pretty horrendous tyrannies. But, you know, the men of the Greatest Generation massacred civilians. I mean, every awful thing that happens in war, they did. But I think a soldier of a war that had such a clear moral imperative to it, like World War II, I think it just makes it a lot easier to live with the memories of that, where something like Vietnam, which was fiercely contested while it was going on, has been subject to lots of second-guessing and lots of dispute about whether or not it was a necessary or even advisable course of action for our country to take. I think it becomes a lot harder to deal with the awful memories that every soldier of every army in every war has ever had to go through and live with. And I think it is that question of where the war stands in the legacy of the national narrative.
I agree. Thank you very much.
Yep.
You're welcome. Other calls are invited. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I don't know if you have the book there with you, Tom, but maybe you would share with us how you wrap up your author's note. I think that would be germane to the call that we just took.
I do not have the book with me right now. I'm sitting in an office in my publisher's. I have it right here. I found it. I pulled it off the bookshelf.
Excellent. Excellent. It's the close of that author's note, and you say, you know, here's something that when we go to war, the people who bring us to that moment rarely admit.
You'd like me to read this part?
Yeah.
War's energies and dark matter are too complicated to allow anyone the certain physics of right and wrong. When war begins, leaders inevitably frown as they promise courage and bravery, guarantee tragic sacrifice, yet vow, all the same, to see it through. What any war's igniters rarely admit are the small, terrible truths that have held firm for every war ever fought, no matter how necessary or avoidable. This will be horrible, and whatever happens will scar us for decades to come. Indeed, even necessary wars can destroy the trust of the people in their leaders, just as war destroys human beings on both sides of the rifle. War is appetitive. It devours goodwill, landscape, cultures, mothers and fathers, before finally forcing us, the orphans, to pick up the pieces.
Is this blindness required in order to go to war?
I think it might well be. I think it's very hard to imagine to mobilize a society to actually contemplate the idea of warfare as being, you know, a useful thing. And, you know, I think we were all guilty of this in the last couple of engagements our country has gotten involved in. And let's forget the political dimensions of this right now, whether or not you're for or against the war in Iraq and or Afghanistan. I'd like to put that aside and just ask ourselves that, would it be possible to actually mobilize a society to think that going to war was a wise, prudent choice if we really sat down and soberly considered what was going to happen? The families destroyed, the lives ruined, the innocent people killed, the millions of dollars wasted. Now, that's why it becomes necessary, I think, to dress war up in a lot of patriotic costume and guises, because it really is the only way, when you're not fighting for something like as primal as national survival, say, to actually mobilize a society to contemplate something as awful as war. And I don't mean whether the war is justified or not. I mean just on its face, awful is what warfare, I think, spreads through the society waging it and the society upon which it's being waged. So I think, yes, I think it'd be very hard to imagine someone actually soberly laying out for the people they're trying to convince to go to war about what they were actually getting themselves into. Mm. But the irony, I'm not sure it's an irony, it's a very bitter irony if it is, but the irony is that that stuff always becomes clear anyway, no matter what happens, you know? So, it's hard to imagine a leader actually laying this out, but it's also hard to imagine a war in which is not going to turn around and blight the person in charge of escalating it with this revelation.
Tell us about your mom, Alicia.
Actually, my mother's name is Alexandria.
Alexandria. I muffed that big time, didn't I? And that's her nickname.
Her nickname is Muff.
Muff, yeah.
And her name is Alexandria.
Alexandria,
and,
I'm sorry.
My mom is a military brat. Grew up in the South, U.S. South. Flew a Confederate flag off the front porch of my home in Michigan. Through my entire childhood, and this is in the rural Upper Peninsula of Michigan, so a lot of my friends would say, "Why does your mom fly a British flag?" And I'd always be like, "Well, forget." Long story. So she was a lover of all things Marine Corps, and just came from a very solidly military family. And she and my dad met in a Marine Corps base in Beaufort, South Carolina, and that was pretty much that. And my mom has been on board for just about every military action you can imagine that this country's ever engaged in, and for a long time sort of believed, you know, like my father, that Vietnam was something that should have gone a lot better and was justifiable. And it's kind of hard to believe this, but I've watched my mom turn against this current war in the last, you know, few years, the last couple of years, and it's been sort of amazing to me to actually watch this process happen to the one person that I thought could be counted on to be the last person standing on the USS Republican. So my mom has sort of undergone, you know, a process of political sea change. And I have to think part of it is my interest in reporting and writing about the kind of places that I do. So she's a very empathetic person, and she's a lovely person. And, she's been one of the sort of biggest the biggest supporters of me, like many mothers. She's a big fan of this book, and that's an amazing thing to say, considering the liberties I take with invading her life. But she's been wonderful through the whole process.
Yeah. What kind of conversations did you have with her growing up about the war?
Well, her father was a veteran of the war, and her husband, my father, was a veteran of the war. And my father was there in 65, 66, like I said, before things turned.
Mm-hmm.
For the worse. And her father was there. He was a Marine Corps bird colonel. So he had a very higher up view of the war. He was not on the ground. He was not a grunt. So he always thought things were going extremely well, you know. And so my mom always just wondered how on earth we managed to lose it. So it had to have been some other party. So, you know, there's the media, there's this, that. So I think I grew up with a lot of information that I would later regard with a lot more skepticism from both my parents about why Vietnam turned out the way it did. But none of this was ever ideological. It was never, it was never overly ideological. I never felt like I was being instructed in some sort of Masonic secret that they were trying to give me the, you know, the secret dope on why the war happened the way it did. It was just their understanding of why this war, which wound up affecting their lives so profoundly in many ways, sort of turned out the way it did.
Mm-hmm. In the book, there are points where you get into the history of Vietnam and the history of the war, and you call these queries.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the queries is, you know, how was it that we came to believe this stuff about the war that we did? You know, why the lies? Maybe you'd talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's a question that was really important to me, was why the United States government lied so often. And let me qualify this by saying I'm fully aware of the amount of lies the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong told during the war. This is not, which, as I say in the book, would if you were to assemble a volume of that, it would have Tolstoyan heft. So I don't want to make any callers think that I'm, you know, unduly singling out the United States here. But the fact is that we are not a communist dictatorship, you know, and I do think we can expect from our own government a slightly more transparent mode of operational behavior. So I was fascinated as I really kind of looked into the diplomatic history of the war, the extent to which they weren't lying so much, as Robert McNamara would argue, was that they were just reacting, and they were creating justifications after the fact for things that had already happened. And when you really begin to look in the diplomatic and sort of higher-level administrative governmental history of the war, they were pessimistic from the very beginning that this was ever going to work. And every escalation that the United States did was a purely desperate move to head off disaster at the pass. And, of course, what they wound up doing was just spreading and delaying this inevitable, some would say, disaster for, you know, 10 years and costing millions of lives amongst the Vietnamese and tens of thousands of lives amongst Americans. You can see this process. Even Kissinger and Nixon, who, you know, were pretty hawkish about, you know, communists in Southeast Asia, even they had basically conceded that this thing was not militarily winnable anymore, and that all the fighting they were doing was just for tactical reasons to have a good negotiating position when we withdrew our troops. So the pessimism about the war is there from the very, very beginning, and that created a very difficult position for many people in charge of implementing the war, because here you are faced with the reality of a situation that was fairly untenable, an incredibly corrupt, incredibly unreliable ally in the South Vietnamese, an indigenous movement of insurgents who were both controlled by the North Vietnamese and both like a legitimate nationalist movement that had a lot of popular appeal, and which had been on the verge of winning power in South Vietnam on three different occasions, each one instigating a desperate escalation on the part of the United States. And I think it became pretty necessary to lie about why the war was going the way it was, because on the face of it, it looked like a pretty hopeless situation. At best, it looked like stalemate at any number of times. And the thing that I learned is that there were any number of people in the U.S. government willing to say that, and they were silenced, and they were silenced themselves, they were silenced by others, not in a conspiratorial way, but in a way that they were pressured. The gag of patriotism was used on them to just hold off and let's not go public with this yet, and several people in Johnson administration just couldn't stand it anymore, and just one of them, several of them, you know, just resigned or were fired. You know, it's never been really determined. Like Robert McNamara still doesn't know to this day whether he was designed or whether he resigned or was fired. And I find him a very tragic figure because he was one of the most enthusiastic truth twisters in the beginning of the war. But to his credit, he sort of saw the war's futility a lot earlier than a lot of other people did. And he basically stopped supporting the war and then resigned because he could not abide the path upon which he saw the United States going down in regard to Vietnam. So I think he gets sort of a raw deal from people who were alive then.
Let's take another call. A listener in Eureka on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I just have one short question, then another one. Were you on WGN Radio the other night?
I was. Yes,
that's
I was.
What I thought. I thought this sounded familiar. I'm enjoying your conversation. One of the things that I think that I've learned, having been strongly against the Vietnam War, which happened when I was in college, is how little maybe those persons who have not been to real war do not understand what the process of war and the training and the environment does to people. And I think that's a large generalization because I think it's accurate. And just listening to you reflect upon your father's experience and others, I think that it verifies that I suppose this is one of the things that people that opposed the Vietnam War did not understand about the people who went. Many probably went for very sincere reasons, and I think you described when they got there, it was a giant morass.
Yeah.
But I just, maybe your comment, please.
Do you mean the forces that war turns up, the things war turns on, and how it changes people?
Yes, what it does to people psychologically.
Yeah, it's a great point, and there's a wonderful book written on this called Achilles in Vietnam, mm-hmm. which is about combat trauma and how the military has proved very successful at getting people to kill people, which is one of the most primary, it's one of the most impossible humps to get a person over, to
yes.
be willing to kill another human being. It's very difficult to actually get people to do that. For instance, in World War II, something like 80% of people in infantry didn't even fire their weapons during combat. This is a little-known fact, but it's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't fire their weapons because they had not been desensitized to the effect of killing other people well enough. So by Korea, the military got that number up to 50%. By Vietnam, it was 90%. Unfortunately, they were not providing a lot of service or psychological training for people on the other end of this process. You teach someone to learn how to kill, and then you set them back free into society, which isn't to say that veterans go on to become brutal, murdering people. Mm-hmm. It's not what I'm suggesting at all, but it does suggest that to set free that impulse in someone and to be able to override it as successfully as modern military training does, and not to really provide someone the tools to be able to cope with that is awakened in them, as I think we've seen that played out in the lives of many veterans who just have an extremely hard time dealing with that. And I think to this day, things are not much better today. I've talked to many Iraq War veterans who've summarized their post-war training as being really as elaborate as they allow it to be. And since soldiers tend to be a tight-lipped group of people, I wish the military would take a more active role in really allowing people to cope with things war makes a person confront within themselves.
I think you articulate it well. And one thing that I think verifies it, I've noticed on the national news, I believe both CBS and NBC say in the last maybe 2 to 4 weeks, there have been numerous reports about how mental health services are little or none available to many of the veterans, and how many are, I guess the word post traumatic stress disorder is used as something to kind of organize it and categorize it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's a broad group of deep psychological difficulties that people go through, but they just the government seems to, as you say, just deal with it little for many reasons. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a wonderful question and an important thing, I think, to keep in mind when we're talking about this.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. In Vietnam, when you and your dad were there, and I think you were either at Da Nang or near Da Nang, your dad said, "This is my Vietnam."
Mm.
How did the landscape affect him?
That's a wonderful question. His Vietnam is coastal Vietnam. I call it the lush green tunnels of Vietnamese countryside when you're driving along, and there's just the jungle is so thick that it's all around you, so you feel like you're tunneling through. And it was when my dad got into the hilly areas around Da Nang and around Nha Trang where he really felt like, yes, this is where I spent all those terrible months, he says, you know, racing up and down the countryside. Seeing these beautiful stone temples called the Cham temples. The Cham are an indigenous people of Vietnam, and these temples at the time were not very widely known, but the Cham was this incredibly elaborate culture and civilization that existed even prior to the time when Vietnamese people were there. And so my father would cruise up and down this amazing landscape, seeing these Cham towers and have no idea what they were. No one really knew then. There just wasn't much research about it then. And so it was seeing these towers, it was seeing the jungle, it really put him back into this... incredibly difficult to break trance that I think he really got into sometimes just looking at these places. And I had no access to his thoughts, but I really wished I had. And in some ways it felt invasive. You know, I really wanted him to have that moment by himself. But at the same time, I was there to write about it too. So one of the running gags in the book is the extent to which I had to, you know, yank his teeth a little bit to get some topic sentences out of him.
And the tape recorder is always there.
Always there.
Yeah,
do a lot of journalism,
yeah.
and you know, usually the ratio of used to unused stuff is about 10% you use and you throw out 90%. But with my dad, it was the exact opposite ratio. I think I used almost all the tape we made. Really, an absurdly large percentage of it is actually in the book.
Yeah. When it came time, when you were at the place where your father had been wounded, you turned the tape recorder on and you kind of said it was more of like, well, I got to do this. But you really learned something there.
I did. I had had a story of my father's wounding that had been vividly in my mind my entire life, my entire conscious life at least, that he was shot several times, and then a heroic Black Marine had dragged him to safety, thrown him over his shoulder and carried him off and saved him. And we go to the place where my father was wounded, and once I'm there, it becomes clear that the story is actually completely wrong, that my father was nearly killed by a what we'd call today a roadside bomb or an IED. It was a huge mound, earthen mound that the Viet Cong had filled with explosives, and it was a booby trap, and it blew up and nearly killed him, and there was no heroic Black Marine, and there was no sniper, That was a story that I'd had in my mind for some reason, and that was very strange. And in fact, when I wrote the pitch to base a contract on for the GQ article I planned to write, I actually included this story, you know, about my father's this Black Marine who saved my dad's life. So it was kind of an amazing thing to actually go to the place with him and find out that I had essentially invented, you know, this this creation myth of my father's wounding.
That's amazing that we do that kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is.
Hmm. We're at the point where we have to wrap up. What would you like to leave us with this afternoon, Tom?
Well, I would like to leave anyone listening fully aware that in my book I try to be as even-handed about this war, which, you know, I have any number of feelings about. But I try to give everyone, you know, my unbroken empathy in this book, soldiers, civilians, and combatants and non-combatants alike. And I think one of the tragedies of warfare is the reductive tendencies it forces everyone to take of everyone else. And what I hope I did in this book is put everyone on an equal playing field. You know, the warriors are there, and their children are there, and they're all sort of together, all trying to deal with the calamity that is war. And I really hope that you know, the book has something new to say about this war that has had so much said about it. And so I do hope that if anyone is interested in the Vietnam War or in how a generation after the fact deals with a war, that they will check it out.
Mm. Tom, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Tom Bickel is the author of The Father of All Things, A Marine, His Son, and the Legacy of Vietnam. The publisher is Pantheon.